When we last met, we were going through some criticisms of Barclay, and I had just gotten some onto the board when our time ran out. Let's have a look then at what's on that board. Barclay says God is one, eternal, infinitely wise, good, all perfect. But his hypothesis doesn't show that God is all those things. It's not all those that are justified. It only shows God is all-knowing and maybe all-powerful. And only in this sense. God's all-knowing in the sense that he knows all of the perceptions that he gives to all the minds, all human minds in the world. And he's all-powerful. Needn't mean more than he gives them all their perceptions. And that's the same thing as creating the world. It consists of minds and the perceptions in minds. But he doesn't have to be infinite in power and infinite in knowing to know everything that's going on in the world and to give everyone all their perceptions all the time. Let's look at another one. The all-knowing and all-powerful need not be perfections. Well, I just made that point. See, he has to have an all-knowing mind to keep everything in existence when no humans are perceiving it. But it doesn't have to be the God as he was defined previously in rational theology as the being with all and only perfections. And then the other attributes of God, goodness, justice, he's all perfect. And the fact that they're supposed to be infinite perfections. This is just something he slips into the discussion without justification. And if there's an old saying in philosophy, what's freely asserted is freely denied. You don't give me any reasons to think something is true. I don't have to give you any to deny it. If he's not going to justify the claim, don't make it. And if he does put forward a claim, give us the justification, give us the reasons why, and we can examine them and go on and discuss it. But if he doesn't give any reasons, philosophically, it's a black hole. Well, this is not a complete list of criticisms we can make of Barclay. In fact, Barclay himself thought of some, and he tried to give answers to them. And the main one that he thought of, and apparently after he published his first work, because in his first work he just blithely assumes there's no problem talking about minds. Sometimes uses the word spirits in order to emphasize that he means that non-physical thing that knows, thinks, wills, feels. Why can't we turn around and use the same critique that he's been using to destroy the idea of physical things to destroy the idea of spirits or minds? I'll read to you from part of his dialogues. I'm assuming that doesn't mean they're coming for me or something. Let's just ignore that. From the dialogues. The two people who are talking in the dialogues are invented characters, of course. One's name is Hylas. It comes from hyle, that means matter in Greek. And the other's name, Philonius, two Greek words that mean lover of mind. So you can tell right away which is Barclay and which is his imaginary debater. Hylas, answer me. Are all our ideas perfectly inert beings, are they agents? Are they active? agents. Or passive percepts. And of course, Barclay, to be consistent, answers they're altogether passive. So he, then Hylas says, "And but isn't God an agent and purely active at that?" And Philonius has to admit that sounds right. No idea can be like or represent God. No idea means no perception. Remember, idea is used in this peculiar way among people from Locke on to mean anything that's in the mind. And Barclay is going to propose the term notion to substitute for that. But for now, there's no idea, that is perception, that is represents God or the nature of God. And Philonius says, no, it can't. Since, therefore, you have no idea of the mind of God, how can you conceive it possible that things should exist in his mind? It should be as impossible for you to conceive of that as for you to conceive of purely physical things outside the mind. Or if you can conceive of the mind of God without having an idea of it, why may not I be allowed to conceive of the existence of matter, even if I have no idea of it? So you're going to have to be even-handed here. You're going to either have to say God is inconceivable, but in the sense that we can form no idea. No perception, no concept. You've already argued that matter is inconceivable. There's no percept. That was his clever reduction argument, right? All the terms that we use of the primary qualities come down to combinations of secondary qualities. And therefore, no concept. Either you're going to have to reject both for these reasons, or I'm allowed matter back into my philosophy. Hylas goes on. You admit that there is spiritual substance, although you have no idea of it, while you deny there can be a material substance, because you have no any notion or idea of it. Is this fair? To act consistently, you must either admit matter or reject spirit. According to your own way of thinking and in consequence of your own principles, it should follow that you are only a system of floating ideas without any substance to support them. No spiritual substance, no mind. Words are not to be used without a meaning, and as there is no more meaning to spiritual substance than there is to material substance, the one is to be expelled if the other is. Well, Berkeley tried to come up with a reply to this. I admit I have properly no idea either of God or of any other spirit mind. I do nevertheless know that I, who am a spirit or thinking substance, exist as certainly as I know that my ideas exist. I know this immediately and intuitively, although I do not perceive it the way I could perceive a triangle or a color or an animal. So Barclay's reply starts with, I'm intuitively aware of my own mind. And that's not something he has put forward before. Remember, he was saying there's nothing in the mind but concepts and percepts. And concepts are all of percepts. So if you don't have a perception of something, you don't know, you're speaking hot air. when you try to name them. Now he's taken it back. So, I was reading from him. Sorry, I lost my place. I'm sure that's never happened to you. Okay, we're right now. So, unfortunately, this difficulty isn't really solved by this move on Barclay's part. I have an intuitive awareness of my own mind. Okay? Then there's something more in the mind than just ideas and concepts. There's intuitions. And why can't his opponent claim that for on behalf of his belief? Well, there doesn't seem to be any good reason given by Barclay why he couldn't. Not only that, this inference, or I think it's not really an inference, that's not a good word for it. Admitting the idea of God on the grounds that, or there is no explanation for continued existence, of things, when no human perceives them. And since we know by the simple fact that the candle burns down when no one's in the room, that they do continue to exist. So this is what recommends the all-knowing mind. But then Barclay has to admit that some contents of our minds are caused by other minds. What does he have in mind? The actions of other human beings. The actions of what we call their bodies is controlled by their minds. So if there are other minds besides God's, and Barclay wants to say there are, then they cause bodily movements in their own bodies, which come to us as sensations, and we see them. So it's not the case that God causes all of the perceptions that come to our minds, and he never quite sorts this out. He doesn't give reasons or make this a consistent system of ideas, because first he says God gives them all, perpetuates the existence of them all by himself knowing them all, and then he says, well, some were given by other people as well, and never really gives an explanation as to how those two fit together. But there's something also different with the philosophy of Barclay's, and it's fair to close by pointing it out. Close our discussion of him by pointing it out. And that is, Barclay wasn't a philosopher by trade. He was a bishop. He thought he had hit on a really clever argument as to why there's no material, but he didn't attempt, the way Locke did, to set up a system and make it all fit together and to think as precisely as possible. Locke tells us that he's doing that at the beginning, and he wants to sort out past theories that he's come across that don't work, and so on. But he's trying to be as precise as possible and explain as much as possible. Barclay was just trying to get across a great idea he had one time. The material substance turns out to be nothing more than our perceptions again, so we never really get outside ourselves or what's given in this narrow little space here of our brains and our minds. Maybe it's not as serious then to Barclay that these other issues are ones he never took up or never solved. But I think it's important to point them out anyway and to say that this is where he left things for another philosopher who was by trade, by practice, a philosopher, and that is David Hume. David Hume came from a somewhat well-to-do family. They weren't ridiculously rich, but they owned their home and they were well off and they didn't have to work for a living. And it meant that his parents sought a position for him that would count as a position of a gentleman. That means he doesn't have to work with his hands. He's not going to work in the fields. He's not going to produce food or mine for something, dig in the mine. He's going to be an attaché to an ambassador or something like that. And Hume got a good education and says how he found himself superior to his classmates mentally. He was born in 1711 and died in 1776. You remember my bad joke about that. It's easy to remember when he died because that's the year Gibbon published The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Of course, it's the date that the colonies in America declared independence. That's how most people will remember that day. This is a time in which science is burgeoning. It's trading off of the work of Galileo and Newton. And you can add to that now Boyle, Volta, Lavoisier, more and more astronomers, and new sciences are opening up. So Lavoisier begins what becomes chemistry, and physics has already started with Newton, and astronomy with Copernicus, and then especially Kepler, who publishes three laws of planetary motion and gives us a mathematical formula for figuring out where in the sky and when we will see this, that, or the other heavenly body. It's caught the imagination of everyone, all educated people, and the public as well. Hume wants to put things on a scientific basis, but he thinks that scientific basis means showing how all of our experience reduces to sensations and combinations of them. So Hume's going to want to be consistent with that. And the way he wants to be consistent is to accept He accepts all the problems left to him by Barclay. And what do I mean by accept? No, Hume is going to admit we don't have any idea of material substance, and we don't have any idea of a non-material substance. Mind is just as ridiculous as material substance. We don't have an idea of God. Barclay tries to say, well, I have an intuition of my own mind, and therefore I can think that there might be another mind, and it might know everything. Oh, get out of here, says Hume. There's nothing in the mind but sensations. He calls impressions, sensory impressions, and copies of them. He calls them ideas. Let's sort our terms out, not use them ambiguously. So what's in the mind are sensations and copies of sensations, and the only difference we can tell by which we can tell them apart is impressions, present sense percepts, are more lively and vivid than the memories of them, which are copies of them. And that's all we have. And yet, rules out mental substance as well as physical. We have to throw that out. We don't know there are physical objects. We don't know there's an external world. And we don't know there's God. And I guess to be consistent, he's going to have to say we don't know that there are other minds, finite minds in the world, but our own. It's a tough corner to be backed into, right? Just stop and think about this. Rational reasoning and theory making is esteemed in Western European culture. And when it's applied to things like astronomy, it comes out with, we can now predict where this heavenly body will appear and when and on what date at what time and so on. That's pretty great achievement. If we take physics seriously, if we believe there is an external world, and then Newton's laws of motion, the law of thermodynamics, the laws of gravitation and free fall, can explain a great many things to us that were not explicable before. Okay? And now we get the beginnings of chemistry, and we get the beginnings of electronics. Volta builds a pile of metal disks set in acid, and he can get a current off of that. That all happens in this period. But when you turn to philosophy, it's supposed to give us the big picture, the total picture. What's reality like? What's the nature of what the real? That's ontology. How does our knowing work? When can we be certain of something? That's epistemology. And what it ends up with is telling us we don't know that there are minds or matter, and we don't know whether there's a world outside our mind. In other words, the farthest it can get, what it delivers or has so far, is called solipsism. That's the view that there's only me. All I know exists is myself and what perceptions I have. And I don't know what's causing them. I mean, it's natural for me to think, along with everybody else, that what causes me to see a chair in the room is that there's a chair in the room. Somehow the chair is causally involved in my having the percept of a chair. But on examination, I can't justify that. I can't justify that there are other minds. Descartes' question, how do I know they're not cleverly disguised robots, has no real answer. Because I can never peel back the layers of reality and get to the mind, and even if I could, it wouldn't register as a percept because it has no physical properties. But is that what the best that philosophy can do? Solipsism? Centuries of philosophical labor and reasoning by the brightest minds can come up with nothing other than, for all we know, each one of us is the only thing that exists, and everything else is either a perception or a copy of a perception, and that's all we can conceive of. humans arrived at this conclusion by doing the same thing Locke did. Locke said what we need to tackle here is to analyze the mind and its powers and how it operates and see what the mind can and can't do. Hume starts exactly the same way. This is Hume. The only method of freeing up learning from these abstruse questions that traditional philosophy has devoted itself to, and show from an exact analysis of its powers and capacity that the mind is no means fitted for such remote and abstruse stuff. We must submit this to this fatigue in order to get rid of it forever. I must cultivate true theory of reality in some care in order to destroy what's false. Accurate and just reasoning is the only universal remedy fit for all persons, all dispositions, and it is alone able to subvert the abstruse philosophy, by this he means the philosophy of the Middle Ages, and metaphysical jargon that, being mixed up with popular superstition, renders it impenetrable to reasoners and gives the air of being real science and wisdom. So Sue has no time for all that talk about essences and God and perfections that went on through the whole Middle Ages. And he doesn't think that the modern period so far has overcome it. Locke started out to try to be critical, so did Descartes, but they both end up with God, souls, perfections, and so on. And Hume thinks that's just silly. Oh, he goes on this way. It's remarkable concerning the operations of the mind that though what's most intimately present to us, those operations of the mind, whenever they become the object of reflection, seem to be involved in obscurity. So we're aware of our own minds, all right, and it seems to be very clear that we have one and that it does operations such as perceive, think, will, feel, conceive, and so on. But then when we turn our attention inward to the mind itself and want to see how it works and what powers it has, it becomes an obscure thing. The eye cannot readily find lines and boundaries by which to distinguish the mind from what is not. The objects are too fine to remain long in one aspect or another and be truly apprehended in an instant. It becomes, therefore, no inconsiderable part of science barely to know the different operations of the mind, to separate them from each other, to class them under their proper heads, and to correct all that seems in disorder. And if we can go further with this mental geography, we want to delineate the distinct parts and powers of the mind. It's at least a satisfaction to go as far as we can. And the more obvious this science may appear, and it's not very obvious, he adds that, the more contemptible it must be to be ignorant of it all, and all pretenders to philosophy and learning. Good idea. Try for the mental geography. This, of course, is what Kant is precisely what Kant's going to do. He's going to say, I'm going to lay out for you the architecture of the mind. Here's how it all works. And he thinks that's the first thing he has to do, then, in order to say what the mind can and can't know. Shall we, I'm going on with Hume, shall we esteem it worthy of the labor of a philosopher to give us a true and system of the planets and adjust the position and order of those remote bodies while we affect to overlook those who, with so much success, delineate the parts of the mind with which we're intimately connected? It would be hypocritical, Hume says, to think that philosophy had made any progress, anything like astronomy. Astronomy shows us now how, when, and where to expect the planets to appear, so on. Phases of the moon. But philosophy hasn't even yet clearly delineated the powers of the mind and come to sound conclusions as to what it can and can't do. Now, Locke tried to do that. In Hume's opinion, he failed. Berkeley, as I pointed out, to be fair to him, he never really tried. And then he caught himself in inconsistencies and things he couldn't explain. Big holes he couldn't even try to plug. Hume's going to say that he doesn't want to be caught doing that. Here, therefore, and I'm reading on in Hume, here, therefore, we may divide all the perceptions of the mind into two classes or species, which are distinguished by their different degrees of force and vivacity. The less forcible and lively are commonly called thoughts or ideas. The other species lack any name in our language, and in most others, I suppose because it wasn't a requisite for anyone but philosophers to come up with distinguishing them. Let us therefore use a little freedom and call these impressions. Employing that word in a sense somewhat different from the usual. By impression, then, I mean all our more lively perceptions when we hear, see, feel, love, hate, desire, or will. So these are perceptions or feelings that are present to someone. And those are more lively and vivid than any memory of any of them, which is less lively and vivid, and it copies them, and those he's going to call ideas. So his two, the first two terms he introduces are impressions, and these are present, lively, and vivid percepts or feelings. Feelings count also in this for Hume. That's impressions. Ideas. That term's now going to be used for less lively and vivid copies of impressions. Memories of impressions, for example. Or reimagining something. Yeah, that was a terrible fire. I can re-picture it in my mind's eye. That's a copy of what was originally an impression. Okay, this much he wants to get clear right up front. What is never seen or heard of may yet be conceived, nor is anything beyond the power of thought, except what implies an absolute contradiction. Now, what we can do here in our with our conceiving power, we can put together impressions in combinations they never had, or parts of one impression and parts of another into combinations we've never seen. We can do the same thing with ideas, with copies of them. We don't have to have the fire in front of us in order to think of, well, fire, let's say, coming out of the nose of a great beast flying through the air, and we come up with a fire-breathing dragon. We can conceive of that, but it's always by piecing together ideas, copies of impressions that we've had. So we can conceive of all sorts of things. He says anything except what's not contradictory. To prove this, the following two arguments will, I hope, be sufficient. First, when we analyze our thoughts or ideas, however compounded, we always find that they resolve themselves into such simple ideas as were copied from preceding feeling or sentiment or perception. So the first thing is that he appeals to Berkeley's argument compound impressions and ideas. Can be analyzed to show they are comprised of simple ideas. So that was the shocker argument of Berkeley, that you take any of the properties that are supposed to be purely physical, and when you go to say what you mean by them, now you know whether you're confronted by one, all you can do is name sensations. So they resolve to or reduce to sensations. So Berkeley, he accepts Berkeley's first argument. They resolve themselves into feelings. And those who would assert that this position is not universally true, or that it doesn't have any, or deny that it doesn't have any exceptions, have one easy method of refuting it. All you have to do, he says, is produce for me one idea that does not resolve into sensations or feelings. Copies of those impressions. And in like way, it will be incumbent on us, if we would maintain our doctrine, to produce the impression or lively perception that corresponds to any idea that we have. So is this term meaningful or meaningless? If I can show what ideas, copies of impressions, it refers to, it has meaning. If I can't, it's meaningless. Throw it out. So we bind ourselves by the same rules that we're asking our opponents to be bound. Second, here's his second big point. If it happens from a defect in an organ of sensation that a man is not susceptible of any species of sensation, this is his second point here. If someone lacks a certain perceptual ability, here Hume is thinking of someone born this way. Someone's born blind, deaf, or without the sense of smell or taste or whatever. Then you can show that we are wrong about this, about our doctrine of what's in the mind. It's always impressions or copies of them, by having, if someone lacks a certain perceptual ability, have that person describe a little convoluted, and it's not Hume's exact words, but I think you had it was up there long enough for you to have it if you wanted to copy it. If someone lacks a certain perceptual ability, then have that person describe to us the impressions that are missed by having that lack. In other words, if you want to deny that what's in our minds, percepts and concepts, impressions and ideas that are copies of them, then have a man born blind describe a color. Have someone born deaf describe a certain sound, maybe as to its pitch or its timbre. If someone born without a particular sensory organ cannot perceive a certain species, he calls it, of perception, then you can show that there can be more in his mind than just the perceptions by having a blind person describe which side of an object is blue and which side is red and where the difference occurs and so on. And of course, he's quite confident they can't do that. The blind can't describe color. The deaf can't know what it's like to hear. Those are the two main examples. This is still Hume. Hence, therefore, a proposition which not only seems in itself simple and intelligible, but if a proper use were made of it, might render every dispute equally intelligible and banish all the jargon of philosophy that's taken possession of people doing metaphysical reasoning and drawn disgrace upon them. So if we could just get this much straight, it'd be a huge step forward. We wouldn't be talking about essences and quiddities, and we wouldn't be talking about proofs of the existence of perfections and God as having them all, and including there actually were arguments about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. We get rid of all that stuff. Let's start by showing the mind has only impressions and ideas. And that's what gives our language meaning. And if you use terms that don't refer to any impression or idea, they're meaningless. Throw them out. All ideas, Hume goes on, especially abstract ones, are naturally faint and obscure. The mind has but a slender hold of them. They are apt to be mixed up with other ideas they resemble. And when we have often employed any term without a distinct meaning, we're apt to imagine that it has a very determined, clearly distinct property attached to it. But on the contrary, impressions, that is, sensations, are strong and vivid. The limits between them are more exactly determined. Nor is it easy to fall into error or mistake with regard to them. When we entertain, therefore, any suspicion that a philosophical term is employed without meaning, we need but to inquire, from what impression is that supposed idea derived? Now Locke, in the end, was willing to admit that, think of Descartes here. Descartes is willing to admit that we have sensations and we have concepts, but he and ideas. But ideas for him are not just copies of the impressions. We know a lot of things that will go well beyond impressions, sensations, see. What were his proposals? Were the laws of logic, the laws of mathematics. We don't know those things by sensation. Even 1 and 1 is 2, we don't know by sensation. Not because it has exceptions, but because we can't see the distant past and future. We don't know that it has made 1 plus 1 has made 2 everywhere and always. And that's what we mean by it. It's the universal truth. So the mind has an innate ability to see logical and mathematical truths and a few other axioms, intuitively grasp them and grasp their truth. Hume's ruling all that out. You get that, right? There's no such stuff. Whatever's in the mind is an impression or a copy of one. An impression's a sensation. So anybody uses a term and we wonder what it means, or they insist, here's a really important concept. Oh yeah? From what sensations is it derived? That Descartes wouldn't allow. You don't derive from sensations. Remember, for him, sensations start our reasoning. They prime the pump. But once our rational minds get working on things, they can see rational truths as self-evident, which are not derived from any impression. They're occasioned by sensations. Having this or that impression is what gets the mind working, and then on its own it thinks of these truths that can't be derived from sensation, like 1 + 1 = 2. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Nothing can be both true and false at the same time in the same sense. We just read something in which Hume said, we can make an idea, we can have an idea that's a copy, a memory, or a concept of any impression that we've had. And the only thing we can't conceive of is what contradicts itself. How is Hume going to show that the law of non-contradiction is derivable from sense perception? That's the task he's cut out for himself. Let me finish that section that I was reading to you from him, and we'll close today's discussion with it. To find out whether a term has a meaning, we need but to inquire from what impression is that supposed idea derived. And if it's impossible to assign any impression to it, this will serve to confirm our suspicion that it's meaningless. By bringing ideas into so clear a light, we may reasonably hope to remove all dispute which may arise concerning their nature and their reality. So, Hume wants precision for any term anybody uses. Tell me what sensations it's derived from. If you can't, you don't know it has any meaning. But I would like to know then about the logical and mathematical truths. The rationalists, like Descartes and Leibniz, held we know some things by sensation, and we know a lot of other things because they're rational, and our mind has the capability of reflecting on the rational order of things. If you press them to how our minds got it, we were created that way by God. God knows all the rational truths. He created them, in my opinion, and Descartes. Leibniz would say they're eternal and uncreated. We're not getting off on that for now. How is Hume going to deal with this? There are no external physical objects. We can't know that there is a thing called a mind. And we can't describe the structure of the mind. We can dope out some of the mind's powers, and we ought to do that. It can certainly perceive. And it can remember or conceive of past impressions. It can perceive, and those sensory perceptions can be remembered or conceived. And that's it. That's the content of the mind. That's all it can do. It's going to be a treat to see how he explains all the rest of knowledge or what he does with science. Hume's not going to want to toss science. He wants to keep it. And remember, the two big drives behind all this stuff that only rarely bubbles to the surface and shows itself is that concern they all have. How can we keep science and free will? We'll see what Hume's answer is to that in our next discussion. See you then.